Yeah, it was just a little introduction to the talk this morning. I was just talking with Venerable Bomali about some of these other monasteries where they do very long retreats. Like that monastery I was talking about the other day, where they only let you out of the retreat if you go in fourth jhana or steam entry, and not before. And about even in the Tibetan tradition, they have these retreats of 3 years, 3 months, and 3 days. And so you can imagine that when there's only 1 week gone, they certainly don't speak, and there's only 3 years, 2 months, and 3 weeks left. But be very careful at this stage of the retreat, not thinking, oh, there's only 2 days, 2.5 days left of the retreat. And instead of like thinking in those sorts of terms, just think that today is a full day where you can do nothing but meditation. But don't ever look at the time in front of you. Never look at the time which is behind you. Only ever look at the time that you have now. Otherwise, the time you have now, this very precious moment, you are literally just throwing it away. Trying to get rid of hours, days, sometimes weeks, sometimes whole lifetimes. Trying to get rid and throw away these marvelous opportunities for wisdom, for knowledge, for understanding. So never ever think there's only so much time left. Even if you ever have the opportunity to do a 3 year, 3 months and 3 day retreat. I think some of you know that story. I usually tell it at the end of a retreat. It just shows you what can happen when you start making these assumptions and jump into the future. And it was the story of, it was a monk from New Zealand, his name was Han Wah. He told us this story when he came to visit our monastery in Thailand. And in the Korean tradition, they also do long retreats every year, 2 month retreats, 60 days. And that really is a tough retreat. Not only is it really freezing in Korea, but also that you have to sit for about 14 or 15 hours a day. And there's no just going out looking at the flowers. When it's time to sit, you have to sit. And when you walk together. And when it's time to sit again, you sit again. It's really, really tough. And he was just a young New Zealander, Kiwi, who had some sort of inspiration to go and become a monk. He never realized just the amount of physical endurance required. And even after just 1 week of sitting like 14 hours a day, now his knees were killing him and his back was aching so much. He didn't know how he'd ever last the retreat. But like many people that you have like endurance, okay, let's keep on going. And sooner or later, of course, you got to the halfway point in the retreat. You know, 1 month, and that was quite a milestone. If I'd done 1 month, maybe I can endure the last month. And sure enough, even though it was incredibly endurance, he was going through so much pain with his body, having to sit so long. And it soon got to the last week, only 7 days to go. And it soon got to the last day, the morning of the last day when he woke up. Wow, the last day. I've only got a few hours to go. And it's amazing when you thought like that, those few hours were some of the worst hours, the most painful hours, the most difficult hours, and also the longest hours. And the longest hour of them all was the last hour, when he sat meditating. Only one more hour to go. How am I going to make it? And you know, his body was exploding in pain. And the hour just lasted such a long time, like a whole month. But then finally he heard the abbot of the monastery finally ring the bell. And just waves of, you know, like the end of any sort of hard endurance, you know, just waves of bliss and relief just swept his body. I made it, wow. And he was just about to get up and go when the abbot said, sit down a little bit longer, please. I've got an announcement to make. You've heard this story before, many of you. And he said, I've just been talking with some of the people on the retreat during the interview time. And they've been telling me they've been getting so much out of this retreat. They've asked if they can go on another week. And I think that's a very good idea. But carry on sitting. So this one monk, just how well he told me that it doesn't matter how much pain he had, he didn't have any pain at all in the next few minutes. He just had anger. And he was determined that he was going to find out who these monks were, who put this idea in the mind of this abbot, and he was going to kill them. Forget these things. He was going to strangle them slowly. And that maybe about 10 minutes passed in a flash, even though the hour before was so long. When you're angry, 10 minutes passed in a flash. Well, he thought of all the different ways to torture and kill these monks once he found out who they were. When the bell went again, and he said, "That's the end of the retreat." And the monk sitting next to him, who was older than him, sort of, you know, edged him in the chest, and he said, "He does that every year." And it was a really good teaching. And what happens to you if you start to live in the future and just hope only another hour, only another 5 minutes, only another 2 days? You're asking for that sort of problem and that sort of suffering. So this time in the retreat, don't fall into that trap. That there's only so many hours to go, there's only so many days to go. Put the mind right in the present moment. Just enjoy this moment. See as much this moment with as much mindfulness and peace as you can. And then there's no worry at all about how long the retreat lasts. While you're here, you're here. When you wake up in your home, then you're at home. That's all there is to it. But don't count the hours. Anyway, the talk I wanted to really give today was to go on from some of the questions and the comments which people have asked in the last few days, to give a rounded talk on non-self. So you're getting all the full heavy doctrines and teaching from this retreat. So first thing is that when even the Buddha taught non-self, taught that there's no person inside of here, that there's no thing you can find to be a permanent, everlasting, existing self, core, or essence. Even the Buddha's day, some people would say, I do not like that teaching. I was just reading, I did bring a copy of the Majjhima Nikaya with me on this retreat, the Middle Lane Sayings, and just reading in there that the Buddha's actually saying that sometimes some people, when they hear that teaching, the teaching for the cessation of all of this, so they get upset and agitated with the thought. It may not be explicit in this way, but the thought of the type, "Oh dear, I'm going to be annihilated, I'm going to be lost, I'm going to perish." And because of such thoughts, they reject or dismiss or turn away from such teaching. Whereas others who would have a deeper penetration would not entertain such thoughts as, "I am going to be destroyed, I am going to be perished," because they understand the teaching of non-self is pointing to the fact there's nothing in there in the first place to perish, to be destroyed, only illusions. But it was this reporting pretty directly of what is reported in, I think it's a simile of the snake, one of the sutras in the Middle Lane Sayings, that it's even in the time of the Buddha, and always, whenever the teaching of non-self comes along and is taught in its fullness, without making any apologies to anyone's ideas or opinions, just teaching as the Buddha taught it, very often there is a reaction inside. Very often there is a resistance inside. It is the illusion of self protecting its own illusion. It's the defilement getting worried and scared. It's craving. Just really worried that its tricks are going to be completely uncovered. This is at the source of that agitation which comes up. So what can we do to avoid that agitation and actually use the teaching of non-self? And this is going to be the main emphasis of this talk. I've already mentioned many times about what the Buddha said about non-self. Now I'm going to talk about how you use that teaching, how you use that doctrine, how you use that tool to dig very deeply inside of yourself. Because as many of you who've been experienced to Buddha's teachings for a long time, that the Buddha's teachings are not a doctrine or a dogma to be believed in, to be accepted just because the Buddha said, but they are, like as in the simile of the raft, they're a means by which you can cross over the ocean of suffering. They're a tool to be used. And so when the Buddha taught non-self, how should it be used? Very often that people, when they come across that doctrine, they just leave it in the realm of philosophizing and intellectualizing. They think about whether there's a self or there's a non-self. And when they start thinking about this, they get themselves in all sorts of knots. As Descartes said, I think, therefore I am. And actually what he should have continued on saying, I think, therefore I am in big trouble. Because of thinking. Once you start thinking, it's called proliferation. And the thinking can never really get to the core of things. Because when you are... when you approach this investigation with an inherent assumption that there is actually something there, when you're actually looking for a self, rather than to look whether there is something there or not, you're actually looking for a self, then you'll never be able to see the truth of non-self. I've given a simile before in some of my talks. It's like looking for the Loch Ness Monster. There's other beings in this world, you can say, looking for the Yeti, or looking for, what's that Australian? Mm-hmm. Well, no, the Bunyip or something, isn't it? Mm-hmm. They're looking for the Bunyip or whatever it is. Well, I just use the Loch Ness Monster. But like looking for the Loch Ness Monster, there's been many research teams who've been endowed with enormous amounts of funds and really enormous high technology, going down in submarines and unmanned submersible crafts with great cameras and sonar detectors and all sorts of really high-tech research equipment. And as yet, they never found any traces of a Loch Ness Monster. But does that mean there isn't a Loch Ness Monster there? Even if they searched the whole body of water in Loch Ness year after year after year, for a century, for two centuries. Does that mean, beyond doubt, can you actually prove that there's not a Loch Ness Monster there? You see how hard, if you assume there is something there, to prove there's not something there. All you can prove is I haven't seen it yet. I haven't found it yet. Perhaps I'm looking in the wrong place. Perhaps it's hiding somewhere else in some sort of cave, somewhere in the depths of the loch. Which is the problem about looking in to the mind, to the body, with the idea of there is a self. If you go in with that idea, there's no way that you can prove that there's not a self there. All you can prove is that this is not a self, or that is not a self. It's not here, it's not there. But there's always that possibility. It can be somewhere else, lurking in the spot which you haven't seen yet. And it's only because of that that the very canny Scots people who run the hotels and the pubs on the area make a big killing from all the tourists. Because of the possibility that maybe there is something there. Now that's not the way we use the non-self doctrine, about using it philosophically. Is there a self or is there not a self? That sort of inquiry will be judged like looking for the Loch Ness Monster. It will lead nowhere. Instead of going using an investigation into non-self as is there or is there not, what one should do is to look and see what one takes as a self, what one assumes as oneself, from moment to moment. Because this is something which is a reality. Not just a thought, a speculation, or some sort of projection of theory, Because the Buddha was pointing out that usually every moment for most human beings, they actually assume that there is a self, an essence, a being there, who is either owning or controlling or somehow involved in this whole process. And it's that assumption of a self, the perception, the thought of a self, which the Buddha says, investigate into. Instead of using an investigation, who am I? Because that investigation, who am I, assumes that you are something, it's just you haven't quite found out what yet. Instead of using the investigation, who am I, use the investigation, what do I take myself to be? What is this source of this thought or perception which I call I, which I call me? Once you start on that investigation, and this is a very powerful way of developing insight into your mental processes and your attachments, because attachments, I think I've mentioned this before, attachments have two ends to them. They're like a stick with one end and another end. And very often people only see one end of attachment, and that's what they're attaching to, the object of attachment. And very rarely do people look and see the other end of the stick, the near end of the stick, what's doing the attaching. And if you look at what's doing the attaching, rather than the object which is being attached to, because sometimes we may have pain in the body, and we attach to the pain. We may have a view in our mind, we attach to that view. We may have a thought, and we attach to that thought. We may have a possession, which is very dear to us, and we attach to that possession. We can see that which we're attached to. But if we really wish to identify this process of attachment, we should also look at the other end. What's doing the attaching? And if you look very carefully, you'll find that whenever there's an attachment there, the near end of this stick which attaches, I like the word stick because stick sort of attaches, sticking, the near end of the stick is always a sense of self, a sense of I, a sense of me. So whenever that you can notice an attachment, to see what do I take to be me, what do I take to be I, what do I take to be a self, follow that process of attachment backwards and inwards, and see if you can perceive what actually is doing the attaching. For example, when you do have a pain in the body which upsets you, and you look at that pain, it hurts, it aches, you know that because it's suffering, there must be some sort of attachment to that. So look at it and trace it back and says, what is holding on to this pain? What is thinking it's a problem? And if you actually trace it back, you'll always come on to a sense of something which you take to be me, the holder or the experiencer. Very often it's the experiencer which you take to be me. It's the experiencer is attaching on to the experience. And it's a very good way to see the whole mechanism of attachment fully. The problem with attachment, the reason why it goes on and on and on, and people never really solve the problem of attachment, is because they only see one end of it. And the hidden end, the end which is right closest to you, is very rarely given any scrutiny. And this way of investigating into non-self is very much going to this end of that stick which we call craving. What is it that's doing the holding? What is it that's doing the grasping? What is it that's going out and grabbing onto things in the world? And you'll always find it's an idea, a perception, an assumption of me. An assumption of me, which with it will always carry an assumption of mind. The Buddha actually made a very powerful statement in the sutras when he said, once there is a self, there has to be things which belong to a self. When there are things which belong to a self, your possessions, what you possess, there'll always be a self. The two have to go together. It's like common sense if you just contemplate it for a while. When there's attachment, these are the things which we assume to belong to me, to be my concern, to be my problem, to be my property. It's what we take to be ours. So we can do this investigation. What do we take to be me? What do we take to be mine? What do we take to be ours? And you always start that on the grossest level first of all, and then make it more refined as your investigation gets deeper and sharper. No matter what you may think in the realm of speculation, intellect, theories and so on, that many of us take that which is our material possessions to be mine. We actually think we own these things, whether it's our car or whether it's our house. And we at least should be able to let go of those. This is not ours, it's nothing to do with me, nothing to do with a self. That should be quite obvious. But if there is attachment to these things, then actually one is, as it were, bringing these things in as part of the self. But a self sometimes is a very huge thing, which is not even restricted to the confines of your body, but which even includes for many people their car, their house, their family and their property becomes their self. Even though it's completely illogical, irrational, because they identify so much with these things, it becomes their ego, their self, even their essence. Which is why that when any of these things get threatened or taken away or destroyed, that is why there is suffering. It is as if part of me is being taken away. Very often that happens when people form attachments to other people and that person disappears. They actually experience, if they're honest enough, part of themselves dying or being taken away. Even stupid people, if their car gets stolen, they look, it's as if this part of themselves has been stolen and taken away. That's the identifying this as being them, this ordinary physical possession. If they can't see through that coarser level, then it's no way you can see on a more refined level. You look at a more refined level and come a bit closer to the body. Now, I made that simile with the possessions such as a house or car, other people, deliberately, because really there's not much difference between another person's body or a car or a house that you think you own and this physical body with a skeleton and flesh and skin and hair, which again we think we own. However, that this perhaps is a bit closer to us and it certainly has a bigger label of I, me, mine, stamped right throughout it. And almost without thinking, due to a lot of conditioning and a lack of mindfulness and investigation, we actually assume this body to be me, to be mine. Now remember, I'm not talking in the realm of theory. You can think about and think, well obviously it's not mine. I'm talking about the actual reality of moment-to-moment perception and thought, which is very often different than what you think you know. How you act is one thing, and how you think you should act is another thing. From day to day, from moment to moment, you actually view this self as being you, me, and mine. And so we're taking this teaching of non-self on a very practical course level, first of all. You know that you're taking this to be a self, to be me or mine, if there's any attachment to this thing we call a physical body. Because you will see it is the thought of that attachment is the sense of I, mine. And if you investigate, you find that many times during the day you assume the body to be a self, to be a me, to be a mine. It's an assumption which you make without thinking. An assumption which occurs automatically sometimes, which is there before you even know it. Every time you hurt yourself, you trip over and get a bruise. Ow, I hurt. If it's an arahat, they never say, ow, I hurt. They say, painful sensation arising, painful sensation passing away. Because they never look or perceive or think in terms of this terrible word, I, me, mine. Every time that you get these little pains in your chest, constricting, not very much at first, constricting pain, and they're just about to spread down to your shoulder. If fear comes up, you think, oh, a heart attack. Maybe I've got some blocked arteries coming up here. And if there's any fear comes up there, the only reason why fear can come up is if that in this whole process of cognition is an underlying sense of me and mine, self, occurring here. This is my body and it's getting threatened. As a woman, every time you feel yourself a lump, sometimes you may start feeling yourself, and this seems a bit harder than it was yesterday. If this fear comes up there, then this is a sense of you've assumed that this body is me, is a mind. And these are the assumptions which we take every day. If someone comes up and tells us, you're stupid, or rather, no, let's keep it on the body first of all, you're really ugly. Why have you got your hair that way? Why didn't you wear some decent clothes? If you get upset at what they say, then you're assuming these things to be a self, to be a mind. You're taking these things personally. You're identifying with the body. The arahat would say, well, this is just a body. What do you expect? So you can see that there's many external sufferings arise in this world because we assume these things to be personal attributes. Even if someone starts to criticize you for being an Asian, for being an Australian, for being a pig-headed man, or a stupid emotional woman, whatever it is, if you're upset about it, you're taking it personally. There's a sense of self in there somewhere, a sense of I or me, mine. So these are illustrations how, without really knowing it, we do very often assume a self with this body of ours. Sometimes people will think that they know that the body is not self, it's just a mass of elements of blood and bone and flesh and skin and other things. And they even go to autopsies and see the body taken apart. However, when the time comes for them to die, that's the only time when they understand whether they have practiced this non-assumption of the self with the body. So this investigation into non-self is not a very light thing. It can fool you very easily if it's just on the realm of thoughts and ideas. Take it to the realm of moment-to-moment perception, moment-to-moment thought. Especially when you're sitting meditation, whenever a pain comes up, if it concerns you, if it worries you, pain in the body I'm talking about, why? Why is the pain painful? Why is the mosquito bite irritating? Why does it concern you when you're trying to watch the breath? you look very carefully, you'll find that there's always going to be a sense of identification of the body with you, thinking this is your business. But it's not the mosquito just biting flesh, but it's the mosquito biting my flesh. I don't know about you, but if I see a mosquito biting someone else, it doesn't irritate me half as much as when it bites me. Because this is my body, okay? This is my leg, this is my ear, it's biting. So look at that very carefully. Why are you concerned? Because you identify this as being my body. It's one of the processes of insight meditation and jhana meditation to be able to let go of these physical feelings in the body. And the only way you can let go of them is by taking away this label of my body. And just even look upon it as someone else's body. You know, when I close my eyes, I don't think of any of your bodies. They're not mine. They're not my concern. Same way with my own body. Just look upon my own body as look upon your body. You close your eyes and it disappears. Now, if you can do that as well, then you're not attaching to the body as a sense of I or a sense of self. You're actually practicing the disidentification of the body as me, as mine. To the point where you just don't look after it at all when you're meditating. You set it up in a comfortable position, cross its legs, straighten its back, make sure it's all comfortable, you put it to bed, then you just go off and enjoy yourself, just like good parents do when they put the baby to bed at night. You're starting meditating, you're putting the body to bed, settling it down, patting its head, right, now I'm off. As mum and dad go out to the nightclub or whatever they want to go to, in this case, then you go out into the beauty of meditation. So the look to see whether you've still got some identification with the body, not in the realm of thought, in the realm of perception, not in the realm of ideas, but in the realm of actual perception, moment-to-moment experience. Can you let this body go? If you can learn how to let this body go in meditation, you're actually training yourself to let this body go at the time of death. Because a very similar experience happens there. You want to go off, in the sense of meditation, you want to go off into deep meditation, and the body is still calling you. I'm aching, hurting, do this, do that, don't let me go, don't let me go, don't let me go. It's very similar to what would happen at death. Mind wants to go off, and the body, don't go, don't go, don't go. The attachment to the body can sometimes be that strong that the mind struggle, is pulled by the body, even though it's time to die. That struggle, that agitation, causes dukkha, which causes a low rebirth. Practice letting go of your body. Practice dying, as it were, dying to your body. So you can just go off into the mind. Feelings, aches and pains, they won't go away when you die. You have to go away from them. You can't wait till the body is nice and peaceful and painless before you die. You have to die while the body is in pain, while the body is disturbed. That's the time when you die. So while the mosquitoes are biting you, while the legs are aching, while the back is stiff, that's the time to let it go and go into deep meditation. That's the time you let it go. And how do you let it go? By seeing who's doing the holding on. Who is actually, what is refusing to regard this bodily feelings as the same as the bodily feelings of the person over there? Not my concern now. And if you can do that and see, you'll see it is this assumption of an I on a very deep and personal level, which will not let these things go. The assumption of I usually works on two basic levels. It's on the level of the experiencer and the level of the doer. And it's these like two aspects to the assumption of a self, a me, a mine. We assume that it's that which experiences the various feelings, and we also can experience it as that which reacts, which does, which pulls switches and pulls levers to control. These are two aspects of the self. Both need to be seen and understood. When it comes to the bodily feelings of pain, for example, there's that aspect of the illusion of self which is the controller. The controller, which always wants to go and sort of try and get rid of these feelings and try and manipulate them, try and do this, try and do that. Now, in meditation, it's good that you can focus in on the controller and see exactly what is this controller, what is doing the controlling. Is it you or is it something else? What does actually pull the switches? Have you any real free choice to pull this switch rather than another switch? Why do you pull this switch and not the other switch? Why do you always do the things you do? That sounds like the name of a song, doesn't it? Why do you always do the things you do, dear? And if you investigate with clear wisdom, it's actually quite frightening to see that many of the things you do, many of the switches which you pull and buttons you press, you have got actually no choice in. You couldn't do it any other way. Even on that deep level, there's no actual controller there. It's completely an automatic process. This becomes quite frightening the first time you see it. So who's doing this when you realize it's not you? And you see what's doing it is just this empty condition process of experience. Like when I was a student at every year at the college I was at, we used to get a hypnotist come up and give a demonstration. It's always really good fun because he was a proper hypnotist, but he's also a bit of a character as well and make everyone laugh. But he told some very interesting things about just the laws of the nature, the physics of hypnotism. Like for one thing, is you can hypnotize a person to do something stupid, which is humiliating to them, which is like to strip naked in front of everybody. But you can never hypnotize anyone to walk over a cliff and kill themselves. The desire for preservation would always override any commands or orders to physically harm themselves. But anyhow, they told like some interesting stories, and one of the interesting stories was they said that you can hypnotize someone to something very humiliating, and you can hypnotize them in front of everybody. So everyone knows exactly what's going on, and then you tell them at the end of the hypnosis that you will not remember what I said about being hypnotized. But when I give the signal, I will just scratch my right ear like this. At that signal, then you will take off your trousers, stand on your head, and sing the national anthem in the middle of the meditation retreat. Just like completely ridiculous. And the interesting thing is, which is very well known to anyone who knows hypnosis, that when the person scratches their ear, the person will do exactly that. They'll take off their trousers, stand on their head and sing the national anthem. But the most fascinating thing is when you ask them, why did you do that? Even though everyone else knows why they did it, because they were hypnotized, they were given a hypnotic order to do so. But the person who was actually doing it will always explain, well, I thought it was a good thing to do. To them, it will be very clear that they decided through their own free will to do that. They'll give some justification, no matter how ridiculous, that was an appropriate thing to do at that time. that they actually chose to do that. And it's quite scary, if that ever happens to you, to realize that what you see to be so clearly my free will, my choice, coming from a personal controller, is not free will at all. It's just an appearance, an illusion, a fantasy. You start to understand, as the Buddha kept saying, that this is completely conditioned reality. It comes about by causes. Causes which are sometimes inside of yourself, as like past actions, karma, tendencies, sometimes outside of yourself. So all causes which give rise to this particular choice, to even think this thought now, which give rise to the choice to take the one slice of bread or two slices of bread for breakfast. It's not you doing that. But so often we assume, we take for granted, that it is actually me making all these choices. That the controller is a self. And with the investigation into non-self, go deeper than the body, go into the controller. That which controls, don't assume it to be a self for a start. Because if you assume it to be a self, then you've lost the plot from the very beginning. Focus in on that. Use your mindfulness. That which controls, the mechanism of control. What actually is that? Is it really a self, a me or a mind? That which does. And the Buddha said, if you focus in on this, with powerful investigation, with investigation which is not assuming what it might find, not taking with it views which might bend the data, because you've got to be careful. Even a scientist, if they go do an experiment trying to prove a particular theory, they tend to bias themselves to bend the data to prove their theory. As Dennis would know, there are some the results which you put on the graph, which you call anomalies. You just rub them out with the eraser because they don't fit onto the graph. And that's standard practice. You actually bend all the data and results to fit the theory you're trying to prove. And that's not the way to do any investigation with any sense of truthfulness. You have to go in there completely willing to abandon and give up your most cherished ideas and thoughts, and just to see the truth of the matter, even if what you find is painful, distressing. Who said that truth is going to be lovely and beautiful? Someone just quoted, they're writing their notes on the Bible. They said the Bible says. No, I'm saying that you can't go and trust in any book, even the Buddha's book. You have to go with a completely open mind, and an open mind that's willing to find the truth at all costs, even if it costs your very existence. So you go in there and say, what is this controller? See its mechanism. And seeing if you can actually find, as they say, the ghost of the machine, something inside. When I was doing this investigation, to make it sort of more easy to understand, I just made a picture of myself of this like being, just at this great control panel, you know, like at the switchboard of a computer, pressing all these buttons, you know, the controller, the essence of that which does is inside of you. I'm thinking, what was it actually pushing these buttons? And pulling these levers. And if you look very carefully, you'll find that there's no one there at all. So it's a completely empty process, conditioned. And you can actually start to see some of the conditions. I think I gave an experience which I had many years ago, which again was one of those experiences which told me something I didn't like to hear. And which, when that happened, just really shocked me. hairs on the back of my head went up. And that experience was that, this is quite a few years ago now, I was in a city centre in Nollamara it was a Saturday morning, and I was just, it was in the, before we made the extensions, and the library was there where the reception area is now, and where the telephone is used to be a tape library. And I was just rummaging through the tape library, and I just noticed that there was a talk by me, recorded on cassette tape, on exactly the same subject as the talk I gave the previous night. I forget what the talk was, but you know, maybe say it was on, say, Four Noble Truths. I'm not quite sure if that was the talk or not, but and I saw that there was a talk on the shelf, the Four Noble Truths, and I'd given that same subject the night before. So it was still fresh in my mind what I'd said. So just for interest, I took the tape out and started listening to it to see what I said. And what really shocked me was when I started listening to it and hearing myself saying word for word, whole sentences, whole paragraphs, explaining this talk in exactly the same way. Literally word for word. And what shocked me when I looked at the dates was the talk I'd given on the Four Noble Truths some time ago was about 5 or 6 years ago. And I was repeating myself word for word. It was on tape. I thought the night before, just as I think now, that I'm choosing every word I wish to say. I'm in complete control of my speech. The coincidence was too shocking. There's no way that I could freely choose exactly the same words in the same sequence, again and again and again. And it showed me that, hang on, it wasn't Ajahn Brahm giving this talk after all. They got the label wrong. It's just a heap of conditioned factors. That's the only way there could be such a repetition. The problem was it always appeared to me that I was doing this, that I was in control, that I was doing the choosing. And it was starting to give me very grave doubts. Maybe I wasn't in control after all. Maybe I wasn't choosing. Maybe this is, like the Buddha said, a completely conditioned process with no one there who can either make this go faster or slower. And that's why that shortly afterwards I gave this this talk on the empty bus. And it was a talk of like a description of the practice of non-self based on the experience of dukkha. It's like being in a bus driving along through life. You're one of the in the seats there. And sometimes through life, the experiences are very, very pleasant and beautiful. And you shout at the bus driver, slow down. I really want to experience this as much as possible. And sometimes the bus driver slows down. But other times he speeds up. Most of the time he just doesn't pay any attention at all. Your pleasant experiences don't last as long as you want them to. And other times in life, as if you're going through a really terrible country and it's just so depressing and ugly and scary. And you tell the bus driver to speed up. I want to get out of here as soon as possible. Sometimes the bus does speed up. Very often it doesn't speed up at all but goes slower. Most of the time it just keeps on going at the same speed. That's like when you have difficult, painful experiences in life and you want to get rid of them. You want to get out of here as soon as possible. And it doesn't happen. This is like called craving, desire and aversion, isn't it? Wanting the bus to slow down when it's pleasant experiences. Wanting the bus to speed away and escape from the unpleasant experiences. And you understand what I mean about shouting at the driver. This desire, this craving. And after a while, when you get very frustrated that all the time you shout at the driver, just so often it does not pay any attention, all the desires and aversion which you create in your mind, very often it does do nothing at all. Even though you're trying to control this bus journey, so often it just leads to frustration. I can't control it. Why? So what you do, there's a time in your journey when you go and find the way from your seat to where the bus driver's seat is. You walk up the aisle and see, like, what is this thing driving this bus? And you go up there with the intention to give the bus driver a piece of your mind and tell this bus driver that from now on you follow my orders. You do that in order to try and control pleasure and pain, and to make this control of pleasure and pain more effective by teaching the bus driver a lesson. But it's a long journey to find out where that bus driver is sitting. It's very difficult. It's called a process of meditation, of mindfulness, of developing calm. But eventually, through persistence and through training, you actually get to where the bus driver's seat is. That which controls this whole bus journey we call life, we call the five khandhas, we call sensory experience. And that is where you get the shock of your existence, when you find the bus driver's seat is empty. There's no one sitting there at all, there never has been. That's called seeing the Dhamma. That's called stream entry, when you see the bus driver's seat is empty. And the consequence of that, once you find out the bus driver's seat is empty, then you stop all this shouting. Drive faster, drive slower, slow down, speed up. Whenever a painful experience comes up, instead of drive faster, speed up, get out of here. When you feel there's no bus driver there at all, you stop shouting. When it's a nice, pleasant experience and you want to linger with it, instead of shouting at the bus driver, slow down, even park. Stop. You stop that shouting. That shouting, that inner shouting, that inner control is the desire and aversion, the craving. If you see that the bus driver's seat is empty, craving stops. When there's no controller in there, then there's no controlling from then on. So this is one way of doing the investigation into non-self. Finding that bus driver's seat and seeing whether there's someone there or not. What is doing the controlling? The other part of the investigation into anatta is to not just the controller, because that's only half of the illusion of self, that which does. Also, is that which perceives, that which experiences all of this. And that's the other thing which we should really go and look deeply into. What actually experiences? What is experience? Very often we fall into this illusion born of language. Because I remember reading a linguist, a great translator, who said, you should never translate from one language to another word by word. Because that's not the unit of experience, words. The unit of experience is the sentences. The sentence represents one phenomenon, one experience. You see that I taste an apple. You can't read the word taste doesn't mean anything unless you're actually tasting something or someone's doing the tasting. The whole unit of experience is a sentence. And he said one of the problems comes is when you translate things word for word and you think the individual parts of this sentence have sort of independent meaning apart from the whole. And that's why again Descartes saying, I think therefore I am, is missing the point. As that Vietnamese monk Thich Nhat Hanh pointed out once, he said he hasn't completed the sentence. Someone should have picked up Descartes when he said that and said, okay, you think I am what? What do you think you are? Because the thought I am is incomplete. That is an illusion. It has to be, I am what? I am this, I am that, I am something. The I am is just a figment which is taken away from the reality of experience, which is always, whenever you have the illusion of self, it's always I am something. I am hungry. I am enlightened. I am a man, I am a monk, I am tired. And it's one of the illusions born of misuse of language. And if you look at this, that which perceives, you realize that that which perceives, again, is just a figment. What there is, what the reality of the experience is, the experiencing. You cannot have consciousness without being conscious of something. You cannot have perception without being perceiving of something. If there's consciousness, there has to be an object of consciousness. If there's no object of consciousness, there is no consciousness. Look at that. Investigate that. And see it's true. Or see if it's not true. It's up to you to find out. And this is one of the illusions which we make. We think that from conscious experience, which is the main element, we split it up into these imaginary character categories. Of consciousness is one thing, and the thing we're being conscious of is something else. And they're two independent realities. When the true reality is just experience, conscious experience. And it's why the Buddha said specifically that you cannot have consciousness without the other five khandhas, without the other four khandhas, rather. If you're conscious, you have to have perception, you have to have feeling, you have to have an object which you're conscious of. You can't have consciousness without being conscious of something. This is the problem. Sometimes you can be conscious of consciousness. That's okay. You can't have consciousness of nothing. Just consciousness. But once you understand that, then you understand a bit more of that which we call experience. Instead of looking at it as an experiencer, you just look upon it as experience, rising and falling, phenomena arising and falling in your mind. And then you come very clear to understanding what the Buddha meant by consciousness. It's just one way of looking at one side of this thing which we call the experience. And also you will not get lost in the idea of there is an independent experiencer, that which knows, that which does, that which sees, that which experiences, cannot be taken away from the object. Because it's in these two areas above all else where the illusion of self hides. The doer and the experiencer. That which knows, that which does. It's up to you to use the strength of your mindfulness, the power of your intelligence, to see both are just assumptions which are not well taken. Experience arises and passes away. Consciousness is a process which always has to take an object for it to exist. When you see that, then a lot of that which you've assumed to be a self, that which you've taken to be a self, is abandoned. And again, once you've abandoned the illusion of self, realize the experiencer is just a process, the doer is just a conditioned reality, then you've got the path open to the deathless. You've got a way to abandon all craving. When there is an idea of self, there'll always be that which belongs to you. When there's that which belongs to you, will be control over what you think belongs to you. There'll be the craving, the control, and that will create frustration, that will create suffering. Because in truth, you cannot control any of this. Why can't you control any of this? Because it doesn't belong to you. One, two, because there's not a controller in there anyway. So it's just a complete waste of time. And as soon as you realize that, the sooner you'll be enlightened. So there we go. That's my thought this morning about how to use non-self. Just to sum it up, I've mentioned a few points here. Just look for that which you take to be me, that which you take to be I, that which you take to be yours. You especially look down upon your body. Do you take this to be me, to be mine, to a self? Not in theory, but in practice. When you crave, when you experience pain, what is the problem? If you can disassociate any feeling of self or mine with the pain, be able to look at the pain as the pain of the person at the back over there, will it disappear? Can you take your mind away from it? If you can't, you're still identifying with it. And also, in the realm of the mind, not just the body, in the realm of the mind, that which does, that which experiences, use mindfulness just to notice that, to see its process, and to see if you can uncover this false assumption of a self, and see the empty seat in the front of the bus. So, are there any questions on this morning's talk? Yes. Yes, that's a very good point, a very powerful point. Can we assume the notion of self is karmically arisen, and can we assume that the abandoning of the notion of self is also karmically arisen? Yes. It's karmically arisen because we've cultivated this notion in the past, and we come into this life with the predilection for this idea of self. We've built it up over eons, and it's interesting that by ourselves we can't abandon it. That's why I was saying that similarly, you can't eat your own head, but someone else can eat your head for you, and that's the Buddha. It's a very powerful and profound point. I'm not quite sure if I can explain it to the point where you'll understand it fully. But the karmic cause for each of us individuals to abandon the sense of self is the Buddha's teachings. Without those teachings from outside of ourselves, we will not be able to break this chain for ourselves. Through our own thinking, through our own perceiving, through our own investigation, without that Buddha's teaching, you would not be able to do it. That's why the Buddha's teaching of non-self at first feels very foreign to us. But after a while it seeps in, and it becomes a karmic cause for us to look at what we experience in a different way. It's as if we look with the Buddha's eyes rather than our own conditioned eyes. So that's the major karmic cause for beings abandoning their sense of self. And that's why they say that only when Buddhas arise in the world can there be other stream enterers, once returners, non-returners, and arahats arising afterwards. The karmic cause comes from the boss.
What allows the Buddha to enlighten
himself? That's another interesting question. Again, it's a bit of a controversy, but it's very clear. It's actually stated in one of the suttas in the Majjhima-nikaya, the Gatikara Sutta, where the Buddha relates one of his past lives, but a very special past life, because this specific past life which the Buddha relates is as a monk in the time of Kassapa the Buddha, which was the Buddha previous to him. So actually the Buddha studied under a Buddha, previous Buddha. That's a karmic cause. And the previous Buddha, Kassapa, he probably got it from some other Buddha. And he goes way, way, way down the line. And someone said, okay, who's the first Buddha? And you can't say that.
This is where the karmic causes come from.
When we as individuals find this subject in the two half boxes, we tend then to say, kismet rather than karma.
It's what?
Kismet rather than karma.
Kismet?
Meaning it's somebody else's.
Okay, yeah. Indeed, like sometimes we do continually blame other people for some of our suffering in the world. And again, that looking outside of you does not lead to the eradication of the problem. It has to go inside. It is a hard basket to crack. It's stream entry. But there's something about it which, even though the mind rejects it at first, there's something about it which tends to linger about the teaching of non-self. It's very, very hard, but you can't really dismiss it. And it lingers and lingers and lingers. And this is one of the reasons why that I encourage teaching jhanas. Because through the power of a mind which has attained a jhana, when the hindrances are overcome, it doesn't appear too hard with that sort of mind. With that sort of mind, you say, well, let's go and give it a try. Let's go and see. And then with that sort of mind, you actually can perceive the controlling process. You can perceive the activity of consciousness, of experience. And you can see this very clearly. And this is where, that when you remember the Buddha's teachings, you say, well, this is what the Buddha meant. Remember, all the teachings are like signposts. They're pointing to a particular aspect of Dhamma. Never confuse the signposts for where it's pointing to. And once you see where this particular signpost is pointed to, and you see what the Buddha saw, then you understand the meaning of this term non-self. You understand why it's called, you know, no doer, no perceiver, just a process. That's why it becomes sunyata, void, empty of this idea of being, doing. And that's a very powerful insight, because it makes the whole of enlightenment possible. It makes the understanding of the thoroughness of dukkha possible, because the sense of self, which will always protect one area which is not dukkha, one area which is not impermanent, it'll keep this to itself. Okay, your investigation can go other areas, I don't mind that, says the illusion of self, but this particular area, don't come in here. This is mine. This is where I live. That's why there's always that, when you're doing investigation, usually there's that resistance to going in this area, which is the domain of the illusion of self. You just can't get in there. I remember one of the monks saying that he was really trying hard, and he was actually physically shaking as he was trying to get into this area of the domain of the self, of the illusion of self. Because there was part of him, his faith, was wanting to find out what's inside of here. But the other conditioning was saying, no, 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 no. And through fear. And this is sometimes a battle. If you've got a very strong mind, then faith can take you in. It's the faith in the teachings of the Buddhas. This is what the Buddha said. This is interesting. Let's go and check it out. And with that courage to be able to really give up everything, literally everything, for the sake of truth. And then you can actually get in there and then to see. At least you will probably be able to appreciate the consequences of having no self, even theoretically, intellectually. When there's no self, no illusion of self, you can understand how craving must eventually cease. Well, there's no possessions. You own neither your body nor your mind. Remember, craving works on the body outside as well as inside. That's where craving works. And as long as you think that something belongs to you, there'll always be craving there. Protecting, guarding. When you own nothing, you've just got nothing to worry about at all in the whole world. But again, I mean, this can't be just as a thought, as an idea. This has to be as a full knowledge. So every moment, you just never perceive in the sense of mind, me, self. You never think in those ways anymore. So pain is just pain. Loss is just loss. What do you expect? So there's nothing to guard. That's why the Buddha says that all things, sabbe dhamme, all things are not worth holding on to. All things. Everything in the outside world, in your body, in your mind, including consciousness itself, willpower, choice, all things are not worth holding on to. Abandon the whole lot. Only then can there be freedom. The Buddha also gave these really powerful similes. He said, you know, it's just like you've got a tiny bit. Actually, this is very poignant because just before coming in here, I went to the toilet and there's a little bit of feces on my finger. And as soon as I saw this, I obviously had to really scrub my hands. He said, just even if you've got a tiny bit of feces on a finger, it stinks. Tiny bit stinks. There's even a tiny. Attachment to a self is dukkha. Even a small amount spoils the whole thing. So you have to like scrub of all attachment to things, all control, all possessions. So you've got nothing left at all. Completely void, completely empty. Why not? Sounds like a good idea, doesn't it? Sometimes that you can inspire somebody, that seems a really good idea, and then a terrible sense of self comes in and says, no, I still want to keep something. You're talking about like attachment basically. Quite a lot of times people say, well, I have these things but I'm not attached to them, or I do these things but I'm not attached to them. And sometimes you don't really know until they're taken away from you whether you're attached to it or not. That's the time when you will find out whether you're attached to it, say your job. If like you go to work on Monday and they say, look, you've been away for a week, we've got someone else. Bye-bye, Sue. Get yourself another job. You're on the dole. That's the time when you find if you're attached to it. Sometimes people think, I'm not attached to my relationship. We've got this beautiful free relationship. She can do what she wants, I can do what I want. Until she actually does start to do what she wants. And then you find out you're attached. There's this couple, I won't tell you who they are, many of you may know them, that they've been on quite a few retreats, and she wants to go up to town and become a nun, and he wants to become a monk. And they're very open about this, and they talked about it together, talked about it with the monks, and they said, yeah, you know, we've had a relationship long enough, the Dhamma's more important, it's much stronger, we've both in our attachments together. And they went up there, and she actually became a nun. And then he found, there's still an incredible amount of attachment to this lady. And he couldn't do it. It's only when actually the attachments or the bond was threatened that it manifested its ugly head. Think now, I like doing this experiment. Suppose that the home where you lived, when you got back into it, you find there was a fire there. And the fire was already like blazing. What would you take out? In there will be your wife, your kids, your possessions. What would you take out first of all? That's attachment. That's what you're attached to. Yeah? Yeah, okay, you're talking, say, with an example of keeping sila, keeping precepts and the teaching of non-self. Should you perceive in terms of a self, or should you perceive it not in terms of a self? The point is, you've got no choice in the way you perceive it. Before you see non-self, it has to be perceived in that way, and it's to be encouraged. So even if you're going to do anything, do something good. So you start with the reality of how you experience life. So there's the Pujicana, the non-Aryan, we do think, perceive in terms of ourself. So with that, make sure that if you have experiences, make them pleasant experiences if you can. If you're going to do something, do that which is noble and good. Makes sense. And as you do this, to do a perception, to do an investigation into who is doing this. So again, this is not to be taken as a theory, as a tool for practice. Look, what is the doer? What is the experiencer? Is there such a thing as an experiencer? Look at one's experience, the process of experience. Look at that which we call choice, will, doing. And look at it with a very clear and open mind. And this is a way that one uses the teaching of non-self. Not as a way to argue with one another. I believe in non-self, but I don't. I'm getting into these big conversations. Use it as a tool to find out for oneself. You will never find out the truth of non-self by talking to somebody else. You find out this truth by meditating. Does that sort of answer the question?
Yes, I just want to know whether I should be making choices
still. You haven't got any choice. It's true, actually. Sometimes people say that to me. Should I keep stealing or should I not keep stealing? You just haven't got any choice in the matter, have you? No, should you carry on meditating or not meditating? Have you really, really honestly got any choice in the matter? Can you stop? You say, well, I can stop, but I don't want to stop. That means you can't. No one. But that's just like papering over the reality. I can do it, but I won't. See, you can't. It's just justifying. In fact, there's no choice in the matter. What's this? Are you keeping silent? Christian. Okay, you must be keeping silent. One can be attached to being a monk as well. Renunciation is not a role. Now, I'm not attached to being a monk. Every time I meditate, I give up being a monk. That's what a good monk does. Because the monk is only the outer robe of the body. It's what you do in the life outside. I mentioned this before, that when I meditate and I let go of those sort of perceptions and thoughts of being an abbot, being a teacher, being a monk. For example, if I thought I was a teacher when I meditated, then all the time I was meditating, I'd be thinking, what should I talk about this afternoon? And how should I talk about it? And how should I explain these things? And you never have any peace. If I think I'm a teacher, or if I think I'm a monk. So that's the way you give up attachment to being a monk, to being an abbot, to being a teacher, or to being anything like that. Renunciation is not a role, question mark. No, renunciation is giving up roles. So that's what you do. You learn how to give up roles. The more you can renounce, the more you can let go. Sometimes people say that to you, say, oh, you're just attached to being a monk. Why don't you prove you're not attached by going and getting some trousers and going down to the movies? And that's really being stupid, because the manifestation of like monk is someone who's let go of a lot, someone who's already renounced. So it's like saying to a prisoner, you're just attached to jail because you're staying in there a long time. Give him the first chance, the prisoner will get out. Give him the first chance, a good monk, and just get out of samsara, get out of being a monk. That's why you know that many of you come to our monastery at Serpentine, and you can't find the monks. They're hiding from being monks, from being anything. When they're in their hut alone, they're not monks anymore. The only monks was the lay person there. And then the lay person, monk, has that different sort of duality. Doesn't mean they give away the precepts or anything like that. That's just the result of letting go. The keeping of precepts occurs naturally. The more you let go, the more the precepts, you don't, as it were, deliberately keep the precepts keep themselves. The manifestations of abandoning. If you abandon sensory desire, you don't have any sexuality. Obviously. So all that just disappears. But if you want to ask another question, you have to go and write it out. Okay, I think that's probably enough again for today. Another hour and a half talk.